I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. Just days ago, comedian Fuquan Johnson, who was only 43 years old, was found dead after overdosing, reportedly on fentanyl-laced cocaine. And while the causes of death for 54-year-old actor Michael K. Williams are still being investigated, several reports suggest that fentanyl may be involved in his tragic and untimely passing as well. The loss of such vibrant, talented souls is a gut punch, and these high-profile overdoses are part of a much bigger trend. Drug overdoses rose 30% from 2019 to 2020. And according to the CDC, fentanyl and other synthetic opioids were primary factors in that increase. Now, fentanyl is often prescribed for chronic pain sufferers, like those who have sickle cell anemia, and it's used for pain management after surgery. But when fentanyl is used by street pharmacists in an unregulated market, it can have deadly consequences for users who are unaware of what they're ingesting. And let's be honest, our typical national approach to these issues is to declare all drugs bad and to admonish drug users to just say no.
Say yes to your life. And when it comes to drugs and alcohol, just say no.
What would I do if someone offered me these drugs? I tell him to take a hike.
I just want to shake some sense into you kids that are using drugs and thinking about using. So remember, don't, or else. Okay?
Nearly 40 years later, it feels like we're in the same place. Drugs are demonized, users are demonized, and the war on drugs persists. So it seems past time for some new solutions. With me now is Dr. Carl Hart, author of Drug Use for Grownups, Chasing Liberty in the Land of Fear. Carl, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Melissa. I'm happy to be here.
And Cassandra Frederick, who is executive director of the Drug Policy Alliance, a national nonprofit working to end the war on drugs. Cassandra, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me. Excited to be here with you both.
So, Dr. Hart, you've helped over the years to take me on a bit of a journey in terms of rethinking sort of the just say no tradition that I was very much raised in as a, you know, a kid of the 70s and 80s. Can you say a bit about what we might need to do to shift our understanding of drug use as a just as a life practice?
Well, let's think about our approach to sex when we were concerned about HIV/AIDS. Some people thought it was bad practice to hand out condoms to help people engage in safer sex. Clearly, we now know that that was not the smartest thing to do. You want to hand out condoms. You want to help people to understand how to engage in safer sex as opposed to putting people at risk, including the community at risk. The same is true with drugs. Some people may say people shouldn't use drugs. That's fine if you say that, but the reality is people are going to use drugs. And so now the question becomes, how do we enhance the safety of this activity? We don't have to rediscover the wheel because other countries are doing this sort of thing. They're grappling with these same problems, and many of them don't have the issue or the concern of fentanyl like we do because they have things like drug checking services. That is where people can submit small samples of their drugs that have been brought off the street, and they can get a chemical printout and an explanation of the chemicals that are contained in that drug. So there are no surprises, like is the case in the United States when people think that they have heroin and they may have fentanyl. Fentanyl, of course, is a lot more potent, meaning that smaller amounts is needed in order to produce an effect. That effect sometimes is even an overdose effect. And so there are smarter ways to deal with what we're doing in the United States. If we simply implemented drug checking, it would go a long way in saving some of these lives.
So, Cassandra, I want to come to you on this because it certainly feels to me like at least 40 years ago when we were having these conversations that the idea that these lives were worthy of saving was often not part of the conversation. There was a sense that if people use drugs and bad things happened, then that was one of the side effects. That was why you have to just say no. I'm wondering if you think there is space now, all these decades later, to begin to make an argument that actually it is the saving of lives rather than the defeating of drugs themselves that is the core outcome we should be seeking.
I appreciate this question because I think we are in a moment of cognitive dissonance in this country around this. There are people who are saying, you know, this is about saving lives. And I think a lot of that has been informed by the racialization of the perception of who has been impacted by the overdose crisis. And, you know, 5 years ago, there was this kind of quote unquote awakening of decision makers who were like, we have to save our children, right? And before, the save our children kind of moniker was like, and protect them from drugs. And I think we still have that, but I think people are also talking about like, we have to save our children from addiction and the pain that they're in. And I think those children were white. But at the same time, what we've seen, and with fentanyl in particular, is that in 2018, they went to criminalize fentanyl as we started to see it more and more in the drug supply, which has only exacerbated the escalation of overdose. And so why I say there's a cognitive dissonance is that the rhetoric doesn't match the practice. But, you know, Melissa, it's never matched. The rhetoric has never matched the practice. And so I think what we're seeing is that there's more voices like people like Dr. Carl Hart, folks in organizations like Tracy Gardner and Monique Tula, who are like leading Black drug policy folks that are trying to disrupt the larger conversation, but the powers that be still do not value the lives of people who use drugs, and they especially don't value the lives of people who use drugs who are non-white.
Yeah, Dr. Hart, can you sort of weigh in a bit on the ways that race intersects with this question?
Well, when we think about race in this moment that we're in, the population is fond of saying things like, oh, now we care about the opioid crises because white people are dying, as if this is new. And that's nonsense. The way that we're dealing with this current so-called crises, I'll explain why I say so-called, is the same way that we dealt with previous so-called crises. When we think about the way we dealt with crack, it was the same sort of thing. White people went to treatment, Black people went to jail. Today with the opioid crises, the same thing happens. White people go to treatment, Black and brown people go to jail. When we look at the numbers, for example, for heroin, people who are being prosecuted for heroin at the federal level, 80% of the people who are being prosecuted are Black and brown, even though we know the vast majority of opioid users are white. And so we know that race always plays a role in these sort of crises in the United States. It's who we are. It is as Brother Rap Brown said, it's as American as cherry pie. So that's not particularly new. And I don't even know if it's helpful. The main thing that the population need to understand is that people will always use drugs. And what our responsibility is in terms of public health officials is, how do we keep our people safe to live another day? Because there will always be a demand for commodities that enhance joy and mitigate human suffering. There will always be a demand for those commodities, and we have to accept that. And our job is to enhance the safety of these activities. And there are ways to do so. I delineate many ways in my book, Drug Use for Grown-Up. The question is, do we care as a society? The people who are dying, many are white, many are Black, many are Latino. But the thing is that one of the things that many of them have in common is that they are poor people who we don't particularly care for. Every now and then we get a celebrity that dies and then we have this conversation. But tomorrow somebody else will die and we won't know their name and we won't have this conversation. And so we need all people of all races to understand that this is affecting people in your community and there are ways to stop this nonsense.
Cassandra, I want to build on this insight from Dr. Hart that people will always, all of us, will use substances. There'll always be a market, right, for those things that enhance joy and reduce suffering, right? When we say it that way, right, we realize in our own lives, we do all kinds of things, whether it's, you know, binging Netflix or drinking, you know, wine, or for some folks, it, you know, it's the use of cocaine or heroin, right, to enhance joy and reduce suffering. I'm wondering, from a public policy level, what are the incentives, right? So the incentive for individuals, enhance joy, reduce suffering. For policymakers, what are the incentives facing them that might make it difficult, even if they have kind of this broader perspective on saving lives? What incentives keep them from being able to move away from a kind of just say no and incarceration-focused drug policy?
Well, I think what Dr. Carhart just really laid out is there's a commitment to ignorance by our decision makers. I think part of the conversation is there is the commodification of the carceral system. So there's a lot of money made in criminalization. I think activists like Bianca Tylake of Worth Rises really outlines the markets that are at play through our strategy of incarceration. I think also people are not, you know, I think what Carl says around substances about increasing joy and reducing suffering is true, but I don't think only drugs themselves can do that, right? So there are other things that people will need, because if we're looking at it mostly being poor people or a lot of poor people who are navigating these really hard things, it's not just that they need drug checking or regulated drugs. They also need housing. They also need education. They also need access to job and employment. And our decision makers, as we're seeing right now, don't want to do those things. They don't want to do the infrastructural things that are necessary for people to be okay. And so I think some of that is cost. I think some of that is politics and ideology, and it's killing us. And so I think that part of the thing that we're trying to navigate, and I think the part of the strategy, which is really important and why Carl's work is so important, is really understanding like what is in the arena of folks around drugs. Like, how can we reduce the suffering? And part of that is drug checking, but also that is the regulation of all drugs. It's providing a safe supply. You know, these people who are navigating this, because right now we're in a drug poisoning situation where our drug supply is adulterated, and it's known and unknown to people. And it really depends on your access point to where you're getting your substances. And so I think there's also this incentive for the government to not pay attention to the thing that's really happening here, which is that we have a poison drug supply, because if they could pay attention to it, the things that Carl is saying would happen automatically. We check our drugs, we create safe supply, we'd have a conversation about legal regulation. But there's financial incentives, there are ideological incentives as to why our policymakers are stuck, not stuck, but remain steadfast in their commitment to controlling people's ability to access joy.
Yeah, I just want to say one word about incentives, because Cassandra laid out some nice things, particularly this need for housing, employment. That's so important for the people who are suffering. But the incentives that keep us in this ridiculous war on drugs is the money. Please don't get it twisted. Every year we spend more than $40 billion in our efforts to control the drugs in our country. And most of that money goes to law enforcement. So when people talk about defunding the police, we really should be talking about defunding the war on drugs, because police are incentivized to make these arrests, to engage in this behavior that increases the likelihood that people will be getting poisonous substances on the streets. Not only the police, the prison authorities, even treatment providers, all of these people participate in this thing we call the addiction industry that does not really serve the majority of people who might be using substances.
So help our listeners to understand a bit about our presumptions about what drugs do to us, and a little bit about what your research over the decades has indicated to you about the effects of drugs, like physiologically, on our bodies.
We get millions of dollars at places like Columbia, for example, to give these substances to people in the laboratory and test the effects. Of course, it's to increase our knowledge about what these drugs do and what they don't do. The concern, though, is that the public doesn't even know that we do this sort of thing. And we have this database showing that these drugs are not as dangerous as they are said to be, as long as people understand things like what they have, the dose, all of these sorts of things we have worked out in the laboratory. They are in the scientific literature. I have published nearly 100 papers in the scientific literature describing the effects of marijuana, opioids, methamphetamine, cocaine, a number of drugs. And these drugs behave in a predictable way. That is, you increase the dose, you increase the effects that you have on blood pressure, heart rate, on pleasure, all of these sorts of things we have worked out in the laboratory, and the data is there for public consumption. But the problem is, much of it is tucked away in scientific literature. I don't know if we should call it literature because it's so hard to decipher for literate people. But the point is that the data are there.
Yeah, if you really want to hide some information, put it in an academic journal for sure. Cassandra, I'm wondering about this point you made of a poison supply. Look, I will be very clear. I am an almost nightly wine drinker. I like my glass of wine. It helps me to unwind. And particularly, I'll say I became truly a nightly wine drinker during the pandemic. I don't know what I would do if there was some real possibility that there was arsenic in my wine. I'd like to think that I wouldn't have that glass, but I do feel like there'd be some Tuesday night where, you know, even if I knew there was some possibility of deadly arsenic in it, I'd probably still have my glass of wine. Mm-hmm. You know, is there any mm-hmm. way we can get to some sense of empathy about what it means to have a poisoned supply?
One of the things that I think is important is that this has happened before. When we think about alcohol prohibition, part of the reason that regulation was so important was that people were dying from a poison alcohol supply as well. So when you prohibit something and you drive it underground, what we basically do is concede that the supply that people will engage with will not always be pure. Like, you just take away people's rights to information about what they consume. And so when we've talked about this particular issue, that's why drug checking is so critical, because people are making policies abdicating their responsibility as to why we are in the situation where fentanyl is really present in drugs. And fentanyl's always been here, right? But the volume to which fentanyl is a part of the drug supply currently is ever changing and dynamic because of our policy around prohibition and the ways that people are really trying to go around the drug laws that we have set. If we can have an adult conversation about these are the substances that people use, what are the ways that we can create access points for people, and how can we give people their own dignity to make choices for themselves and check them, that would be important. People, they're like sommeliers who, when you go get your wine, they talk to you about what's in it, what's going on. Like, you know, we're seeing this with cannabis. When you go to the dispensaries and people say like, well, if you use this, this is helpful for this. And this, we've done this before, right? And we've regulated drugs because we wanted that information. And it's the same moment that we're in right now, but the histrionics and the racism and the classism that is associated with drugs are impeding us from actually getting to a place where we can have adult conversations about our drug supply. And the thing that is really, it to me is like the red herring, is that we're not talking solely about one substance, and we never have been. Like, you know, when we were first starting to talk about the rise in deaths, a lot of it was because people were mixing substances, right? And didn't know how mixing certain different classes of drugs was going to impact their body, because we can't have conversations. Now we're more presently dealing with a poisonous drug supply because of the way that we've regulated drugs and the incentives that we have to not actually deal with regulation and drug checking.
So, Dr. Hart, let me ask you the final question here. I know in your book, Drug Use for Grownups, you lay out some very practical steps. I know people need to read the book, and you can't lay out all of them, but can you give us maybe just the top three or four, or just, you don't have to rank them, a few sort of key practical steps to addressing this issue?
Yeah, so if we're really concerned about people dying first, the first thing that we would do is that we would implement drug checking services in the United States. They're not that expensive. They are in other countries. These services allow people to submit anonymous small samples of their substance, and then they get a chemical printout and readout, and they are educated about what substances are contained in their drugs that they submitted. That way, people will know if there's something like a fentanyl in the substance, don't take it or take a smaller amount of it. That would go a long way in saving people. Another thing we can do, and we should do immediately, we have this new administration, whoever takes over the Office of National Drug Control Policy, the first thing they should do is start some national public service announcements to help people to understand which drugs they can mix. You know, like if you mix opioids with other sedatives, you increase the likelihood of overdoses. But if you mix opioids with stimulants, people find that combination to be good. That is not as toxic as mixing opioids with other sedatives like alcohol, benzodiazepine, and other sedative. Those two things will go a long way. And people need to understand that this is not new. They do this in Europe, where they don't have this problem of drug overdoses as we do. And then finally, what we need to do is we need to stop exaggerating the numbers such that people in the country seem to think that the overdoses are always caused by opioids. That's just simply not true. Opioids make up maybe about a half of the overdoses, but the way it's presented in the press is that the opioids are responsible for all of these. And even when opioids are involved, minus fentanyl, there are always multiple drugs involved. So opioids themselves are not the problem. When we act as if opioids themselves are the problem, what we do and what we've done is that we have made it difficult for people who are suffering from pain-related illnesses to get their opioid pain medications because physicians are afraid to prescribe opioids because of this current hysteria around opioids. Meanwhile, those pain patients are suffering in silence. Some have committed suicide. And that is not right for a society that calls itself compassionate and free.
Carl Hart is the author of Drug Use for Grownups, and Cassandra Frederick is executive director of the Drug Policy Alliance. Thank you both for joining The Takeaway today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
This Saturday marks 20 years since the terrorist attacks of September 11th. And like so many people, I remember precisely where I was as I watched in horror as the second plane crashed into the South Tower of the World Trade Center. I was standing in the kitchen of my Chicago condo, drinking a cup of hot tea before work and rubbing my 6-month pregnant belly. My eldest daughter was born just a few months later and is part of an entire generation for whom the post 9/11 world is the only world she's ever known. From heightened airport security to casual Islamophobia in popular culture to the vague realization of a bloody war being waged half a world away, her generation experiences all of the abrupt and terrifying changes of September 11th as utterly mundane. Normal. So we wanted to know how you, our parents and our teachers, talk about and teach about 9/11 with the young people in your lives.
This is Ali from Taunton, Mass. As a history teacher, I make an effort to balance teaching about the absolute horror of that day with the horror of discrimination and loss of freedoms that many Muslim Americans faced after that day.
Some of you have relied on your faith to guide any and all discussions about 9/11.
In our family, we have had numerous discussions about radical beliefs. For us, 9/11 is just one point of entry on this very, very large, complex topic. As Quakers, we try to share how the world's resources and their distribution is skewed. We also try to empathize with people in dire circumstances whose home country infrastructure and social safety nets are even more tenuous than they are here in our country. Keeping ourselves from othering people keeps our perspectives on the strength of those joining our citizenry. And we're teaching our kids to believe that right sharing of our world resources ultimately helps the United States as much as foreign diplomacy and foreign aid does people in other countries. Our kids are learning to face issues with compassion and facts, not fear. This is Holly Freeman in Portland, Oregon. I listen on KOPB.
For others, you've yet to have conversations about 9/11 with your kids because they're dealing with just too much already.
Hi, my name is Daniel Johnson, Brooklyn, New York. I've been trying to break this this tragic moment in our history to my children. They're 8 and 7 years old, and they saw me looking at a trailer on Netflix. And 2 weeks ago, I was looking at Spike Lee doc. And I think they're not ready for that. I think it would shatter their perception of our world.
And at least one of you has relied on your personal connection to that day to inform how you talk about it.
Our children were 20, 15, and 10 on 9/11/2001. My wife was an employee of the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey on her way to work in One World Trade Center when the planes hit. She was late that day, so she was on the PATH train that terminated at Exchange Place rather than in her office on the 61st floor. 11 of my wife's immediate co-workers perished. So we always talked of the tragedy with firsthand knowledge of the tragedy and reverence for the dead. Rob Orr, Metuchen, New Jersey.
All right, other listeners, what about you? If you're a parent or a teacher, how do you talk to your children or your students about 9/11? Let us know by calling 877-869-8253. That's 877-869-8253.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
There are four questions Jews ask to mark Passover every year. This Passover is leading many of us to ask more questions, once tied to our identity as Jewish Americans. I'm Matt Katz, and on the next Notes from America, we'll talk about hard conversations happening in Jewish communities right now, how we can heal our divisions, and why this Passover feels different. Available wherever you get podcasts.
Reduce, reuse, recycle. It's very easy to do. It's simple to remember. Recycle what you use. Separate glass and paper. Separate plastic and tin. Then put them in their places in the recycling bin.
You're listening to The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. And we've all been taught the three R's from a very young age. In fact, most of our conversations about recycling focus on the responsibility of us as individuals. It's one small thing each of us can do to push back against the effects of climate change, right? But did you know that in most places, it's individuals that also foot the bill for recycling? That's right. Taxpayers like you and me make recycling programs in the U.S. possible. That will no longer be the case in Maine, which recently became the first state to require companies that create consumer packaging to cover the costs of recycling it too.
We are the first domino in the United States to fall on this type of policy, but we're just following in line with the rest of the world. My name is Sarah Nichols, and I'm the Sustainable Maine Director for the Natural Resources Council of Maine.
For environmental advocates like Sarah, the new law, which establishes something called an extended producer responsibility program, is a really big deal.
This is signaling to companies that are polluting our environment that they have a bigger role to play than what they're doing now. We're changing the narrative from, you know, what they're trying to spin as personal responsibility and individuals making better choices, when they know, and we all know, that it's actually these corporations and companies who have the majority of the power.
Maine was the first state to pass this kind of bill, but Oregon quickly followed with its own version. And several other states are currently considering similar legislation. For more on this, we turn to Winston Shea Chagrin, a reporter for the New York Times covering climate change and the environment.
The Maine law, which was signed in July, and the Oregon law signed in August, are known by this kind of jargony term, extended producer responsibility, or EPR for short. And essentially, they mandate that manufacturers pay for the cost of recycling their goods. And in this case, it's the cost to recycle their packaging. So manufacturers who sell almost any product, from toothbrushes and toiletries to snack items, are going to be charged a fee for the cost of recycling the packaging of their items.
Tell us a bit about what that actually means in practice. How can they be held responsible in this way, and particularly in just one state, if they're packaging things and selling them throughout the country?
So they're going to be charged a fee based on the weight of the items they sell. The fees haven't been set, but they're based on a number of factors, including how recyclable the product is and whether it includes toxic materials such as PFAS. So they'll be charged a higher fee for items that are more difficult to recycle, and they'll be charged a lower fee, relative fee, I should say, for items that are easier to recycle or have a more viable recycling market. So things like paper and cardboard have a really strong end market already. I think one of the key points here is how companies are going to be thinking about design, and it's going to require a kind of shift in mindset. So if design has typically been about branding or marketing, companies are going to be incentivized to think about whether their products are designed in a way that makes it easier to recycle. I spoke to one recycling advocate, actually, who worked in waste policy for the state of Massachusetts in the 90s. And he described the impact of one dairy company's decision to change from a clear plastic bottle to an opaque plastic bottle. And the clear plastic bottle had a higher value on the recycling market than the opaque bottle. And it caused this cascade of kind of effects, including the fact that the recycling costs for the new opaque material increased across the state. And I think it highlights kind of the fact that producers have their own reasons for choosing the products that they do for their packaging, but they haven't really considered the cost of the material at the end of its life. And so the idea is that companies may only be charged a fee in one state, but they might be starting to think about the design across all of their products.
This feels like such an exciting development, in part because I am now officially old enough to remember that there was a moment when sort of recycling was pushed as sort of the only thing that we could do about global climate change, right? Well, everybody should just recycle, to another sort of period in this, this process of coming to understand human responsibility for climate change, where recycling has been almost mocked, like, oh, why even bother with recycling given the size and scope of the challenges that we are facing. But this is, it feels to me like bringing together that structural piece of recycling and not making it just about an individual consumer issue, but really about sort of all of our products and how they get to us and what they're made of.
Some environmental advocates described this law as transformative. And I think the main reason is just that the recycling industry has been in such a state of crisis. Recycling, as you say, has been mocked. It had become truly unsustainable because the costs of collecting and sorting and processing recyclable materials was just so high. And it was previously the responsibility of normal people, the municipal governments, and now it's going to be the responsibility of manufacturers who are putting the items on the market in the first place. You know, that is really significant, and it's very different from what's happening today. The cost of picking up your recycling bin when you take it out every week, it's borne by you, the taxpayer, whether it's, you know, through a direct fee to your waste hauler or through your taxes.
So globally, is this extended producer responsibility an approach to recycling that we're going to see?
EPR, or extended producer responsibility, already exists in a number of countries, including nearly all of the EU member states, Japan, South Korea, and a number of Canadian provinces. So it does exist in this form, in terms of covering packaging, across a whole range of countries. And it does exist in more limited forms in even more countries, including countries in South America and Africa. Actually, EPR already exists in a very limited way across 33 states in the United States. So EPR has a really strong track record, I would say, of working. I should back up and say that when I say it exists in a limited form in the United States, they apply to only a really small number of specific products like carpets, mattresses, paint, that account for a tiny percentage of our waste stream. And by contrast, this Maine law, and the Oregon law, which covers packaging, is going to cover an estimated 30 to 40% of what people throw away.
And how do these laws, we talk a little bit about how they might help to benefit the earth, which really matters. How does it also benefit those people who live on the earth in Maine, right? The residents, what difference does it make for consumers and for municipal governments?
It's going to make a really big difference for municipal governments. And I would say for people living in Maine, because they're the people paying for, you know, the municipal government's recycling programs. I mentioned before that recycling has just become extremely expensive for municipal governments. It involves, you know, the cost of collecting recycling bins, transporting them, sorting, finding an end market that they can sell recyclables to. One environmental advocate in Maine described this new EPR bill as the difference between having a recycling program and not. So without the EPR bill, they felt that recycling just wasn't going to be viable in the state. And I just want to back up and explain kind of the context in which these laws are happening. So I think in order to understand why this is such a big deal, we need to understand kind of the way our recycling system has been working. And it's important to note that recycling is not just this altruistic, feel-good government project. It's really a commodities market. And the viability of the products depends on the availability of a market. So in 2017, China announced it was going to be closing its doors to most recycling imports, and it decimated the recycling market in the United States and much of the world. Before that point, the U.S. had been exporting around 70% of its plastics to China, and it had a startling effect across the country. Philadelphia, for instance, saw its recycling costs increase from $5 a ton to $106 a ton.
Wow.
Which is a really significant jump. In Maine, the Department of Environmental Protection estimated that it became about 67% more expensive to recycle than it was to landfill or incinerate. And so, you know, municipal governments had to make really tough decisions. Some smaller governments stopped picking up their recycling altogether, or they started sending recycling to landfills or incinerators. And so I think that speaks to kind of how tough it's been for municipal governments to keep their recycling programs afloat.
So given all of these positives, where is the opposition to this coming from? Because not everyone supports these laws, right?
The industry in lobbying on the Maine bill felt that they didn't have enough of a voice. They wanted funds to be managed by industry. Another key source of criticism was that it would make your grocery bills go up. Oregon actually carried out a study of Canadian provinces that had EPR against those that didn't, which refuted that grocery prices would be going up. But that's really been where most of the source of most of the criticism. And I should add that a lot of companies have actually come around. So just to give, you know, manufacturers credit, there was a document leaked from Coca-Cola Europe, which depicted EPR as a policy that the company was going to fight against in 2016. But Coca-Cola has since come around to say that they would support EPR policies. And a number of major corporations have also signed pledges saying that they would support EPR policies in state houses. So I think that that speaks to the fact that everyone is kind of aware that recycling is not working. Municipal governments are aware of that. As you say, people have been mocking it. Consumers are aware of that. And corporations are increasingly aware of and willing to deal with that.
Winston Che Chagrin is a reporter for the New York Times covering climate change and the environment. Winston, thank you for joining The Takeaway.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Just over a week ago, Hurricane Ida hit the Gulf Coast as a Category 4 hurricane. Winds from the storms damaged homes and businesses and left more than a million customers in Louisiana without power. Then the storm moved towards the northeast with heavy rainfall that caused extensive flooding and overwhelmed drainage systems. At least 50 people were killed in six eastern states. WNYC News reporter Karen Yee briefed us on the aftermath of the storm in New Jersey.
In New Jersey, I would say the northern and central regions of the state were hardest hit by the storm, and it took many local officials by surprise, just the sheer amount of rain that fell in such a short period of time. In some cases, officials were telling me that they were expecting 3 to 4 inches of rain and minor flooding. Instead, they got 10 inches of rain in about 3 hours. One of the hardest hit boroughs was in Manville, Somerset County. Here, people's homes are just completely emptied out into the street and the lawns. I mean, there's furniture, couches, cabinets, toys, diapers, just littered all over and piled many feet high. Along Main Street, the businesses here as well suffered. All of their stuff, all their equipment also piled along the sidewalks. Across the state, 27 people died, mostly in floodwaters, either in their cars or trapped in their homes. There was one particular family of three with their neighbor who died in the same apartment. This was a complex where the first floor was just completely inundated by the floodwaters.
And in New York, reporter Gwen Hogan from WNYC News has been following how residents in Queens are dealing with the aftermath of Ida.
Unlike Hurricane Sandy, where low-lying waterfront areas were most impacted, this hit random pockets of the city all over that just happened to be slightly lower in elevation. Some of the worst flooding happened in middle and working-class residential Queens neighborhoods, home to immigrants from all over the world.
It's very hard to see a home we grew up and getting destroyed, you know? I think we just need a home as of right now.
We're just cleaning and cleaning, and it's just, you know, there's like no help from anybody. I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know how we're going forward. I don't know. The city needs to do something. This is like blocks and blocks of people. These are their homes.
I went to one part of the borough where every home in a 5-block radius took on more than 5 feet of water. People lost family photographs and mementos, furniture and appliances. In some cases, the basement was the family's whole apartment and they fled with nothing as the waters rose. 13 people died in New York City, most of them in unregulated basement apartments.
While northeastern states took the most recent hits from Ida, the state of Louisiana still has hundreds of thousands of homes and businesses without power. And the total damage is estimated to be in the range of $50 billion. In the city of New Orleans, the aftermath of Ida has been an ongoing challenge. At least 5 people have been found dead at the city's senior living facilities. And this past weekend, residents without power were shuttled to shelters in northern Louisiana and Texas. I spoke with Councilwoman Cindy Nguyen, the council member for District E in the city of New Orleans, which includes New Orleans East and the Lower Ninth Ward. She told us about the damage from Ida in her district.
I have the largest district in Orleans Parish, and it also includes Fork Pipe, Lake Catherine, and Venetian Isle. We're seeing a lot of wind damage. And of course, you know, with the power being out for the entire city, it added more stress and damages to the area. But power line being down, trees, because, you know, New Orleans, we were on that path of really utilizing our natural resources to improve the environment. And we have a lot of beautiful oak trees that were impacted by Ida. And we have, you know, of course, homes collapsed from the wind from Ida. And so there's very similar concerns in every neighborhood. But right now we're trying to get people power to their home, help with cleaning up trash that has been sitting, and then just making sure that people continue to stay healthy and sane, Melissa. It is, it's a handful. You know, what I'm seeing all around is people are neighbors or helping neighbors. And that's just a beautiful thing to see every day.
I so appreciate you making the point about what a large District E is. I want to dig into the power question first for just a minute, because New Orleans East is a bit different than other parts of your district. New Orleans East is a place where I think most of the power has been restored, in part because power lines were built underground. It's kind of a newer part of the city. Is that right? I'm wondering if you could maybe compare the power outages that you're experiencing right now in different parts of your district.
Yeah. And of course, you know, I have no electrical background, but from what I've been in communication with Entergy almost every day, and because we do have underground wiring, it has helped us greatly. And then in addition to that, the Northern East plant that we're utilizing to power up over, I think right now the count is that we're over 100,000 household has got power because of that plant as well. Without that plant, Melissa, I think most of us in Orleans Parish will still be in the dark. But I do have areas that have wire out, the lower nine in particular. We've been very fortunate that most of that area has been restored as well. But the key for the East has been that because most of our wiring is underground. And I think as we clean up from Ida and as we move the city of New Orleans forward, we need to look at investment in making sure that every community has better infrastructure. And, you know, definitely going to be pushing for underground wiring for all neighborhoods in District E.
These districts that you're talking about, or these neighborhoods, New Orleans East, Lower Nine, these were some of the hardest hit 16 years ago after Hurricane Katrina and after the levee failure. Have you been talking with folks on the ground there about how they're feeling now with another monster storm that hit on the exact same day?
Yeah, of course, very stressful. I didn't leave New Orleans. I stayed. We were doing praying session on the day that Ida hit and just keeping everybody sane because my phone, Facebook, social media, people were very overwhelmed. And yeah, so it's very painful. But I hope and I believe that with the work that we've been doing for the past 7 to 8 days, people recognize that we're not repeating history in District E, Melissa. You know, we're going to make sure that our families are going to be able to rebuild, tapping into resources, making sure that we help every families in our community.
With everything going on, Councilwoman, how do you find joy or resilience in these moments?
When I see neighbors helping neighbors, when I get stories from people saying, hey, Cindy, I'm cooking, you know, enough food to service 100 people. Where can I go? You know, and I see that over and over, Melissa, and it's so beautiful to see and to watch how, you know, residents taking charge of their neighborhood. I'm just honored and happy to play a very small part just to connect people together and collaborate with them when they have issues and really give them the power of taking charge, right? Because as citizens, we need to take charge of our neighborhood. And as I see little kids, I'm a sucker for children, Melissa. I have six children. I'm expecting 2 grandbabies. I have one coming in 3 weeks. And then I have one coming in 6 months. Seeing kids being strong and smiling and just helping their parents, that also brings joy to me. But yeah, just seeing everybody working together and moving our community forward.
Councilwoman Cindy Nguyen, Council Member for District E in the City of New Orleans. Thank you so much for joining The Takeaway.
Thank you so much for having me, Melissa.
All right, y'all, that's all we have for you today. And as always, we appreciate you tuning in. If you missed anything or you want to listen back, check out our podcast. You can find us wherever you get your audio or head on over to thetakeaway.org. And as we approach the 20-year mark of 9/11, we want to hear from you. How are you feeling about this painful moment in our national history? How will you be thinking about and marking the day this year? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or you can record a voice memo on your phone and then send it to us at takeawaycallers@gmail.com. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris Perry. This is The Takeaway, and we're going to be back with you tomorrow.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.